Would like to ask for those who would like at home. We're going to be doing a simple ritual or ceremony today. So if you have nearby some elements for the ritual, you can participate in that. So those at the center will get to participate in their own way. So if you have a candle, a bowl with some water, a ladle, or any kind of Buddha statue or inspiring statue of an inspiring figure, any or all of those elements, flowers, or if you have a flower, any or all of those elements will be welcome in our ceremony. So you can gather those over the break.
All right, welcome back. So I'd like to just say a few words about the Buddha, his life, and also connecting it with the theme for this month, which is right view or wise view, part of the Eightfold Path. Because this sense of the right view that we were trying to cultivate and understand here at Seattle Insight is a process, right? It's a process that we gain our deeper and deeper understandings as our practice opens and have deeper insights. We understand the nature of it as our practice goes through these years and experiences. And in some way, you can see the same thing reflected in especially the early years of the Buddha, where he was trying to struggle and trying to figure out this quest, this thing he called enlightenment, to understand what awakening really was. So the Buddha started, as many of you know, in a really nice situation. I think many of us would be envious if we had that kind of living situation where we had basically all our needs met before we even anticipated having them. Like he would have, you know, people covering him from the sun or from the rain. He would have everyone who was ill would be kind of sequestered away. They would go by and, you know, clip all the dead leaves and flowers each evening. So he had this really sense of everything was being really beautiful, youthful, just a really nice situation. And we have a little bit of that with our, you know, Amazon Prime, when we can have our wish met almost that day. Sometimes literally that day or the next day. So the Buddha was kind of had it pretty good there for a while. So why did he become the Buddha? Why did he develop this thirst? And we could see that the view of his life before he started this quest was not so wise. It wasn't the wise view. It wasn't the right view. Because it was really based upon the conditions of life giving happiness. The conditions of his health, his youth, his body, his possessions. That's where he placed his happiness. But then he received a really a strong shock one day when his charioteer took him out into the, you know, kind of without permission, out into the town, into the city. And he saw for the first time someone who was sick. And he was so shocked because he had never seen anyone sick before. It's hard for us to imagine that, but someone so sheltered, and he was, what's wrong with this person? What's going on with them? The charioteer says, no, he's just sick. And the Buddha asked, well, will that happen to you? Yes. Will it happen to me? Yes. So then he's, you know, his whole foundation started to be shaken. This is this movement from unwise view. Often life starts to teach us through suffering, teaches us through things falling apart, through impermanence. And through that teaching, we can move toward practice. We can turn, find a different way, as the Buddha started to do. Of course, the next day, as the story goes, he went out and saw someone who was very old. And he was, again, very shocked because he had never encountered someone who was aged, whose body was bent over and had arthritis, and it was, you know, wrinkled and, you know, gray hair and all those conditions. Right? Again, is this something strange? Does just this one person have this? No, it's part of this human condition. Will it happen to me? Yes. Again, a deeper shock. And the third day, going out and seeing someone who had died and was being carried to the grounds for burial, for burning. And again, what happened to this person? Is this unique to that person? No, we all have that fate. We all share that fate. So these three heavenly messengers profoundly shook up the Buddha's view of the world, his view, his way he perceived himself in the world. He saw that that led to more suffering. It was not sustainable. It was not basing happiness upon the conditions of life, of youth, of health, of living forever is unsustainable. Unsustainable. And then the final messenger was someone who is trying to find the solution to this. What is outside of these conditions? Where is there happiness outside of these worldly conditions? And that's what motivated him to start to practice. So you can see how it's shifting from this view of happiness being based really upon our situations, our circumstances, our possessions, to finding happiness that's outside of that, that's beyond that. What is that? And that began his practice for 6 years. Part of this movement into wise view, there's this little phrase, this little quote from the suttas, from the Majjhimakaya 26, where the Buddha was reflecting that he was really seeking happiness in things which are always changing, always in flux. There are maybe sometimes they were good, but then sometimes they weren't. A piece of fruit's going to become rotten at some point. So you could see that he was seeking happiness in things that were constantly changing and how unstable that was. But even more reflected that I too am constantly changing. The sense of me, the sense of my perception, the sense of my body, my sense of my health, all these things are also changing. So how much sense does that make to be seeking happiness that's lasting and something that's changing from a place of change in itself? So this is this movement into a deeper understanding of wise view, of right view, aligning with this understanding of impermanence, of anicca. So the Buddha left his home, you know, gave up all his possessions and started to wander. And he found a couple of teachers that were very influential early on. These were teachers who were masters of jhana or samadhi states. And the Buddha studied to such a depth that they actually said, you know, your knowledge now is equal to my own. So please teach with me. Let's teach together. But the Buddha realized even those states that he had obtained, even though they were so sublime, so beautiful, so peaceful, he realized those two were subject to change. Those two were impermanent. Those two were dukkha because they were changed. Even though they were very pleasant and enjoyable, they still were insubstantial. And that didn't satisfy this deep hunger that had awoken in him to find what is beyond this law of change, what is beyond the deathless. This teaching, to quote, again, Majjhimakaya number 26, this teaching does not lead to dispassion, to fading of lust, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to the base consisting of nothingness. I was not satisfied with that teaching, and I left to pursue my search. So this is an interesting reflection for us as meditators, because I think we could all say that our lives are more, there's a greater quality of stability, greater quality of ease that comes from learning to meditate. You know, for most people, there's that capacity that we are able to be more present, have more of a sense of balance with the comings and goings, the worldly winds blowing this way and that way. And then sometimes we become a little attached, such as some of those meditative states, those ones that feel so peaceful, so quiet, that there's this deep sense of tranquility. And you've probably, if you've noticed that, when you don't have those states, there's a special kind of suffering that comes up from that, trying to get back to those states. When I teach residential retreats, whenever someone says, yeah, that last meditation retreat was so sublime, so beautiful, I want to continue that on this retreat, I know that that's probably not going to be that case, because that very sense of searching and yearning pushes it away. Yeah, because it's that clinging, that sense of wanting. So the Buddha could have gone down that pathway, but the wisdom that was awakened in him, this understanding of a right view, he wanted to see something that was outside of this change, even in these meditative states. So Buddha's life so far, right? Really great situation. Taoism needs met almost instantaneously. Then he's developing this really sublime meditation state. So his next phase was really almost self-mortification, starvation, sitting, you know, very still, really developing strong concentration states. A quote from the suttas, I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain, and crush my mind with my mind. Then as a strong man might seize a weaker by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him, so with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed my mind with my mind. Sweat ran from my armpits while I did so. Though tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness established, yet my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful effort. But such painful feelings as rose gave me no power over my mind. Right? So this is going the other extreme, going into this sitting, really pushing our bodies, forcing ourselves to get to awakening, this retreat, this day, this year. And it went to other forms. He would eat very little food, because that was part of it, was what's in vogue, is kind of this purification of the body. If you punish the body enough, you get purified, and then you get to awaken or to heaven. But he saw that his body was basically dying, that he was close to death at some point. He could actually feel his front side of his spine through his belly. He was so close to starvation. So again, this learning of what's right view. This has gone too far into that diligence, into that striving. And then this image came to him of this time he was sitting under this rose apple tree. In the sense of the rose apple tree, he was actually reflecting when he was just a young boy watching his father do a ceremonial planting of a field. And he was just relaxed. He was just simply abiding in the moment. He wasn't striving. He wasn't trying to get anywhere. He was just at peace. And in that peace, he realized there was a level of tranquility and steadiness of mind that arose from that. He discovered this middle way of not too much indulgence, not too much non-indulgence, but just that middle part. You care for your body. You care for your mind. And in that way, that actually became the seeds for him to become awakened. So reflecting upon that time, and then he took some food, and it's interesting, when he took some food to nourish himself, he actually got some criticism from his comrades, his people he was studying with, because they were all kind of into this, let's starve ourselves to enlightenment kind of thing, just really pushing their bodies, and they thought he's got really weak, he kind of gave up the quest. And this is, and I think also a good teaching around right view, because sometimes our society, the people around us, our culture doesn't necessarily support wise view, doesn't necessarily reinforce that. That's one of the gifts of having like-minded people, people who are also practicing and kind of understanding this terrain, because they understand why you would come and sit quietly for a half an hour or 40 minutes, or why you would go on a retreat, or why you do all this. Because they understand, this is the Buddhists to understand, that this starts to open up this gateway into awakening. And so finally he got the conditions right, kind of under the right balance. And then his famous night under the Bodhi tree, that's where that resolve came in, to sit no matter what happened, what arose. and his mind would throw at him all these distractions and the personification of Mara, trying to get him off his seat, to entice him with desire, to scare him with fear, and finally doubt. By what right do you have to awaken? And the Buddha touched the earth to affirm his place, to affirm his right. And the first words it said that he spoke after awakening from the Dhammapada, seeking but not finding the house builder, I travel through the round of countless births. Oh, painful is birth ever and again. House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build a house again. Your rafters have been broken down. Your ridgepole is demolished too. My mind has now attained the unformed nibbana and reached the end of every kind of dukkha, every kind of suffering, of craving. So in this way, the Buddha discovered wise view. He discovered what it was to be right view by often seeing what wasn't. And this is how we'll see as we go through the rest of this year, the right view sets the stage for right intention, which then goes into our actions, how we actually show up in the world. Actually, it creates how we meditate. And so hopefully this day of Vesak, celebrating the Buddha's birth and awakening and passing, all in the same first full moon of the month of May, can inspire us. You can see, okay, sometimes I get confused. I lose my way. But right view is something that we continue to cultivate, and it deepens as our practice deepens. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you for that reflection.
Carrie, she's going to give a talk now so we could pop up the volume. Okay, go ahead, Carrie. We had your volume all the way down.
Did you just say pump up the volume?
I did. Okay. We're having a party here.
I don't think I've ever been introduced quite that way before.
Over there in Hood River there.
Yeah, that's right. All right. So can everyone hear me okay now? Great. All right. Thank you, Tim, for that beautiful reflection on the life of the Buddha. So this is Vesak, as Tim mentioned. So this is a day in which people throughout the Buddhist world celebrate and reflect, as Tim just did, on the life of the Buddha. It's a day where people go to monasteries, they make offerings, they commit to practicing more, to taking the refuges and the precepts, perhaps spending some more time in silence or meditating. So this is a day in which we reflect on the Buddha's life and teachings and path. And it's also a day that's meant to give rise to inspiration and a feeling of gratitude and respect. So we'll, in that vein, we'll offer some teachings as Tim did. I'll offer a few reflections, and then we'll do a ceremony. So we'll chant the refuges and precepts. We'll do a ceremony involving making offerings to the Buddha. So I did in the guided practice, I like to reflect that on this day, people all over the world are celebrating and inclining their minds in this direction, in this wholesome direction. And this feels particularly powerful to do right now, where there is so much happening in the world that it's very easy to have a kind of cynicism and discouragement and despondency kind of take hold in one's mind. Quite easy. Anyone noticed that? Or aggression, frustration. So here on this day, we're invited to remember that there is the possibility to move in this very different way in a human life. So there's also a tendency many of us have to reduce practice to a particular method or technique, right? And to a particular form. And then sometimes we wonder why it feels rote or dry or kind of mechanical and why we can't make it work. But Dhamma practice is meant to engage the fullness of who we are, our wholeness, our full humanity, or the full catastrophe, as Nikos Kazantzakis said, sort of the Greek, the full catastrophe. But this Dhamma flows, it ignites, it flows, and it deepens in an environment of gratitude, of respect, and of care, of giving. And we can't fabricate that. We can't make that happen, but we can recollect, we can remember, we can incline our minds in a direction. So yesterday I was trying to convince my son to write a Mother's Day card to his grandmother. I was trying to kind of nudge him and coax him, and writing is not his favorite thing. So there was a lot of resistance and kickback. And so I sat him down with the card and the pen. I said, just bring Grammy to mind as clearly as you can. And just think about everything you really, really like about her, everything you love about her. And I left and I came back. And after a lot of hemming and hawing, suddenly he had a whole page, whole page of a card. And I said, that's great. So what happened? And he said, well, once I really brought her to mind and really started thinking, I just kept thinking of more things that I like and more things and more things. And pretty soon I had a whole page. So this is what we do when we recollect the Buddha, right? We don't force ourselves to have a certain kind of experience, but we turn our minds towards, like Tim mentioned, some aspects of his life that are inspiring, that we may be able to relate to in terms of turning away from perhaps things that we discover are dead ends and that help deepen our search and our commitment. So when we recollect the Buddha, we recollect a human being like us, who at some point did not know he had potential. I like to reflect on this part. Like, he likely didn't know that he had the potential. He wasn't born a Buddha. Sometimes we use the word bodhisattva, which means like a Buddha in training or a Buddha to be. So we are all bodhisattvas. We all have this potential. We're all cultivating this potential. We're all Buddhas in training. But at some point, he did not know that he had potential. He followed the stirrings of his own heart. He kind of took the feedback when what he was doing wasn't working. He was able to change direction, get inspiration when it came his way, and experiment, right? So he had his own questions, his own way. So the Buddha or Buddho means awakened, awake. So again, this reflects the potential that is possible for all of us. We all have this awakening potential. I remember the teacher Eckhart Tolle once saying that perhaps figures like the Buddha, who had transformative shifts in understanding, were like early flowers in the evolution of the human heart mind. Yeah. So I remember hearing him say, you know, there was a time in which flowers didn't exist. Yeah. Way back, there was a time where flowers didn't exist. And then one day there was a flower. The first flowers started to appear. And the first flowers were quite simple. The more developed parts evolved later, and then insects and pollination and this full flowering came later. But in the beginning, there were just single flowers opening. So I always found this an inspiring symbol and an inspiring possibility that our maybe the evolution of our potential awakens much like a flower, in which conditions aren't right for a long time, either individually or collectively. And then suddenly they shift and something opens. So suddenly and gradually, right? And then as we are now, a lot of us are inspired by and encouraging the awakening in one another. So there aren't just solitary experiences of transformation. There are many. So for many of us, seeing the embodiment or experiencing the embodiment of somebody who was going in a different direction or has a different sense of commitment or integrity or presence is what sparks us on the path. I know it's definitely been true for me. So also we likely wouldn't be here otherwise. We wouldn't be here without this awakening, without this transformation, and without such a clear articulation of the teachings that we can follow and put into practice. So I mentioned this in a talk last month, but we can pause in any moment and really remember, I too have this potential. I too can commit to that which supports clarity and kindness and wisdom. I too can commit to awakening on behalf of all beings. This isn't to say that things don't fall apart, that our plans don't get frustrated, that we often don't feel lost and confused, but we can renew and refresh those inspirations and those commitments again and again. There's inspiration in remembering our own potential and our own goodness, what it is that we're committed to. So this can bring a tremendous uplift and a sense of gratitude in the heart. I know I've experienced this several times lately. I may have mentioned this also in a talk, but in situations that feel quite difficult or challenging, you know, personally, socially, collectively, just to remember in a moment, there is a path. Yeah. There is a path. There is a way, not to fix this or solve this or wrap it all up, but there is a way to turn towards this. Yeah. To hold this, to remember the possibility of widening the view, yeah, expanding the view, as Tim was saying. So this act of ritual that we take part in, that we participate in, is something that is meant to evoke a sense of reverence or deep honoring of this inheritance, right? So we honor our capacities, we slow down beneath the waves of spinning thought for a moment, and we intentionally move our bodies, bring forward our voice in a certain kind of way that's meant to remind and refresh our sense of possibility. So Tim will explain the specifics of the ritual with what we do with the water and the gestures and the pouring of it. But just to keep in mind that whatever we're doing in the ritual, it's as though we're doing that also to our own hearts and minds. Right. So whatever our notion might be of the historical Buddha, whatever that relationship might feel like or not, like when we're pouring the water and we're really attentive and aware, it's as though we're cleansing and clearing and honoring our own minds. Yeah. We're paying respects. But we're also cleansing, clearing, honoring our own minds. So this is also a way of clearing, obstructions, resentments, that which hinders and blocks. And we do this in a non-conceptual way. We do it with our bodies. So I remember watching, Ajahn Suchito. Tim might have actually been at this. I think Tim was at this retreat. Perform a puja or a ritual on a retreat. And it was so simple. The elements were so simple. And he first just took about 2 or 3 minutes. I don't think we're going to do this tonight, but he took about 2 or 3 minutes just standing in the doorway of the hall. And then just slowly walking towards the Buddha, the front of the hall, just step by step, as though he had all the time in the world, just with full embodied presence. And then he did some very simple bowing gestures to the Buddha, just poured water into a bowl and offered it to the Buddha. And the way that he did this with such, felt like such sincerity and a fullness of being, was one of the most moving things I've ever seen. Yeah. Dhamma talks are incredibly inspiring to me. I get a lot of inspiration from talks, but this was a different level of just watching this reverence, deep respect, gratitude in an embodied, such an embodied way. So this has always been quite, this aspect of ritual has it. In the beginning, it didn't make a lot of sense to me, but seeing teachers embody it and practice it has really kindled my inspiration for it. So it's very good to have something that is worthy of respect, right? We see a lot that might not be worthy of our respect, but it's very good to have something near that is worthy of respect, worthy of our offering. Something that when we recollect it, we remember it, it kind of lifts us out of our self preoccupation and catastrophizing and fuming. It lifts us out of that. It refreshes us and allows us to begin again. So a lot of Vaisak is about new beginnings, clearing, kind of clearing, allowing the old to be cleared. And refreshing, allowing a new beginnings, allowing us to begin again. Okay, so thank you for joining me in that reflection. And now, before we do the ritual with the Buddha, we will chant the refuges and precepts. So this is something we do at the beginning of the year. So it's likely familiar to a lot of people, often beginnings, almost always at the beginning of retreats. And what we'll do is we'll do the first part in Pali together. And then the second part, the precepts, we'll do call and response. Okay. So I'll have the Ken can put the slides up. Great. Thank you so much. And maybe somebody could give me a thumbs up first if you can see. Can you see the screen? Great. And do people at the center have, do you have sheets? Do you need sheets?
We're ready to go.
Okay, great. All right. So this is the, we do these three times. Many of you will know. And so if you're brand new to this, you'll catch on very quickly, right? And the wonderful part of chanting is that there's no way to get it wrong. So I'm very nasally right now because I have a cold. But it's really about your intentionality and joining in something with other people. So those at home, unfortunately, it's too chaotic if you unmute. But I really encourage you to use your full voice at home. Okay, so as I said, let's do the refuges just in Pali. So you can read the English, but we'll just do the Pali. And then when we get to the precepts, we can do call and response, Pali and English. Okay. So some people like to put their hands together. Please do whatever feels natural and right for you. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Okay, so now we'll take the precepts together. So these are our collective commitments to non-harming. And we can just refresh these beautiful commitments. Anatipata Weramani Sika Param Samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from killing. I vow to cultivate compassion towards all beings. Adinadana Where amani sika palam samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. I vow to practice generosity. Kame su mi chachara. Veramani. Sika param. Samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. I vow to cultivate responsibility. Musawada. Veramani. Sika param. Samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from harmful speech. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. Sura Maria Majapamadatana. Veramani. Sika param. Samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from intoxication which leads to carelessness. I vow to consume items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. Idam me silam. Magapalanyanasa Pachayo Hotu. May my conduct be the condition for the attainment of the highest fruits of liberation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you. Never seen this before, but a little notification popped up. It says, it appears you're speaking another language. So they're on to us. All right. Thanks, everybody. Nice to be with you today, practicing together.
All right. Thank you, Carrie. Thank you all for chanting the homages and the refuges and precepts. So now we will move into this ceremony. So as Carrie mentioned, we have the different elements. Let's see if we can make that. So those, where are you? Okay. Yeah, those online, you can kind of see it. We'll try to get a closer view in a little bit. But basically, we have the four elements. We've got water, we've got fire in a second, we have stone represented by the Buddha, the crystal can represent air, and we have flowers to represent new life. So as I'll invite, we have about 40 people here, so we can't do the, you know, couple minute walk up kind of thing. Otherwise, we'd be here till midnight. So you can kind of do your reflection, and when you get up there, just, you know, make it a brief but meaningful connection. Now, depending on your relationship to the Buddha, to statues, and to that kind of stuff, you can find your own way to it, right? You can make it something that you can find accessible. So if you feel like you're very devotional, then I can have that quality of devotion. Taking some water from the ladle and maybe washing over the Buddha as an offering. Or maybe, you know, you have a different relationship. You don't know about this whole, you know, Buddha stuff and worshiping stuff. So it can be more of just connecting with your own intention for practice. All right. Does that make sense? And online, you can find, hopefully you have, even just a bowl of water could work, just putting with a spoon, kind of doing that in, connecting with your intentionality. And Carrie, we have some music to play while we're doing this, right? So I think Ken can get that queued up.
Yeah, so this is, some of you may have heard this. This is a metta chant that is a kind of offering. So this quality of loving kindness, may I be well, may you be well, may we be well. So you'll pick up on it really quickly, and we can just listen if you'd like to chant along as you're doing it. That's also great. But you can also just listen.
May we be well. May I be happy. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy.
Thank you for this very sweet ceremony. It's lovely to watch everyone come up and feeling those at home participating also, just that sense of coming together with this celebration and honoring of the Buddha and also the honoring of our own practices. And Carrie, would you like to say a few words?
Just echo my deep appreciation for everyone participating in this. It was really moving to watch people come in and interact with the ritual in this way. So thank you for your sincerity and participation.